Our next speaker, Dr. Tom Lindell, is with the American Humane Organization in Denver. He actually started as an anthropologist, and then along the way spent about 12 years as a social worker, delivering clinical services. The last number of years, he's been in the research side of things. I think it's sort of an odd combination, Dr. Lindell, to find a bean counter and an anthropologist in the same body. Am I off base here? But Dr. Lindell has actually crunched the numbers on a lot of different things. What does it really cost? Is it better to have someone incarcerated, or is it less expensive to corrections and the state to do something else with them? What are those real monetary costs to families? That kind of thing. So I think you're going to be very intrigued with Dr. Lindell's information. He's also very patient. So a lot of us who are in this field are more that people person, and we're not so much a numbers person. That's why I think you're a real oddity, Dr. Tom. So don't hesitate as well to stop him, and he's happy to explain to you how he comes to some of his answers. I think especially in light of the budgets, not only in New Mexico, but across the country, and probably not just for this year, but for several years, we're going to need to look at just this sort of thing. How can you truly take care of these families? How can you, give them the services they need and stretch that small handful of dollars that Deputy Secretary Oliver has to spend? So, Dr. Lindell?
Really?
Thanks very much, Shirley. I wanted to say that, as I did last night, that I was honored when Charlotte asked me to come and present to the legislators and this morning to you. I basically regard this group as the professionals that are involved in this area. And I suppose I feel a lot of kinship with you since I was a professional social worker for a good deal of time. I just wanted to correct one thing that Charlotte said. She said I worked in clinical services. Actually, I was a community organizer and program person. So my responsibilities were program development. And I worked on programs for delinquent kids.
Program
clinic,
you know.
What's the value of doing cost-benefit analysis of this stuff? Basically, when you put a person in prison, you're making an investment. And I want to explore how that investment has performed. And the tools that we have to do that, the logical tool, is cost-benefit analysis. I started doing this about 5 years ago when I was invited to examine the how effective Hawaii's correctional policy was. Hawaii was suffering from the consequences of the war on drugs, and that meant that Hawaii was incarcerating an accelerating number of its citizens, and they couldn't build prisons fast enough to hold them. So Hawaii was sending large numbers of their inmates to the mainland to private prisons in places like Arizona and Oklahoma. I don't know if they sent any to New Mexico, but they sent a fairly large number. Imagine what that does to family relationships. I mean, it's bad enough on the islands, where they have seven islands, and they have two major prisons, one on the Big Island and one on Oahu. Most people who are incarcerated in Hawaii are actually incarcerated on an island different from where their family is. So what is the value of the investment you're making? I mean, you're investing the taxpayers' dollars. What kind of a return are you getting on that? Well, let's take a look at this. This is just a little warning. A lot of the research that, and I'm going to display more than I showed the legislators last night. I'm going to show you more of my Hawaii analysis. It's sponsored by a foundation. The foundation doesn't want me to release all the details until we've had a chance to offer it up to Hawaii itself. So I'm going to withhold some of the detail of my analysis, but I'll show you bits and pieces of it. I just ask that you not further disseminate it. I've added slides to the presentation. So the presentation that you see printed in your spiral-bound book, there's only one table in there, and that table didn't print correctly. You will see that table correctly offered here, plus two additional tables. Okay, here's the structure of my presentation. Let's go back here. I want to explain to you what the concept of social cost is, because that's the framework in which I'm operating. I will show you an inventory of the social costs of incarceration. Then I'll show you examples of costs for parent drug offenders released from Hawaii and New York prisons. I've done the analysis both for New York and Hawaii. And I'll show you some comparable costs for New Mexico, New York, and Hawaii, just to sort of put New Mexico in a perspective. But I don't have enough and the right information from the Corrections Department in New Mexico to do the analysis. It would require closer cooperation. But a few of the facts they gave me suggest where New Mexico may fit into a broader picture. Okay, what's the concept of social cost? To be very brief, because I have fewer minutes than I did last night, social cost looks at the cost of an activity from a society-wide perspective. That's what social cost is. Now, we can get more technical within that, and there's a lot of literature on this, but basically, it's cost from a society-wide perspective. Another way of thinking of it is when you take some kind of fateful act, it's going to have a series of downstream consequences. There's a chain of costs that are entrained from that act, and that's what we're looking at when you put a person in prison. Your costs are not limited to the period of incarceration. There are other consequences that follow. And you have to not only look at the costs, sure, you have to look at the cost of the prison bed and the cost of parole, but there are some other costs involved that are usually not considered. And I want to bring them into the picture. In other words, I want to create a holistic picture of what is the value of this investment that we're making when we put a person in prison, particularly for drugs. I'm very interested in looking at particular cohorts or particular groups of people, because the first major finding of my work is that the investment of incarcerating a person has vastly different returns depending on who the person is and what kind of crime they have committed. Now, the costs of incarceration fall on three parties: the community, the family of the offender, and the offender himself. I use the masculine because 92% of state prisoners are men, only 8% are female. Okay, so the components of the cost-benefit analysis of incarceration. First, we'll look at the elements of social cost, the elements of social benefit, and cost-benefit profiles of different kinds of inmates, and examples of estimated costs and benefits, bearing in mind that all I'm going to cite here are framed in 2006 dollars. Okay, now, the inventory of social costs, a major input to this, this hasn't really been explored. When I started looking at the literature on the social cost of incarceration was very underdeveloped. So I went looking for inspiration, and where I found inspiration was in the literature on substance abuse. There is a highly developed literature about the costs of alcohol and drug abuse in the United States. And the federal government has sponsored periodic studies that attempt to survey the costs to society of alcohol and drug abuse in the United States. I mean, they started doing this in about 1981. And about every 5 years, they funded a major study by researchers. And those studies are excellent sources for identifying the elements of social cost. Let me lay these out for you. First of all, when you put a person in prison, there are what we call CJS costs, arrest and sentencing. I won't go into detail. You can imagine what those are. There's pretrial detention. which occurs for a certain proportion of cases. There's the cost of legal defense, public and private. That means that that people who are brought up, for example, on drug charges, but generally, they have costs. They have to pay for their legal defense, but a certain fraction of them, and it's a fraction that we can identify, also get public defenders. So part of the cost of legal defense are public and part are private, and we can actually identify that, and I did. There's the average cost of the prison bed, and you can frame that either in terms of marginal cost or marginal plus capital costs. There's reduced child supervision by the inmate. When you put the person in prison, they're not there to supervise their kid, to be a role model for them, if they can be that, and so on and so forth. And you can actually quantify these costs, and we did. There's foster care for children placed due to incarceration. This is a complicated topic. I'm not going to go into it because of our limited time this morning. I discussed it briefly last night. And I've discussed it in my written work. And if you want to see an example, a full example of this analysis, I refer you to a paper called Spreading the Pain, the Social Cost of Incarcerating Parents, which analyzes the New York data. There's training of probation and parole agents and others. This is part of the social cost of putting a person in prison, training costs. I don't have good estimates for this, but it can be developed. My asterisk at the end in all of these slides will indicate costs that are not yet estimated, but the ones that lack asterisks, I have estimated. And that was just a means of shortening the presentation. There's family support of the inmate is a social cost of incarceration. You know, they go out and visit the inmate. They send money to the prison for commissary costs. Now, I learned in a conversation last night that apparently prisons charge administrative fees on money that family sends to the inmate. I didn't know that. Like I was told last night that by a person, when we sent $50 to Dad, who was in prison, the prison, Dad only got 20 and the prison charged 30 as an administrative fee. I mean, I don't know if that's accurate, but I didn't even know that there were administrative fees charged when family provide, is that true?
No, I don't think so. Probation probably is like fees.
Yeah, right.
But not in prison.
Okay. Well, this the example was from Kentucky. So, I mean, not pertain to New Mexico.
Okay.
So, I mean, I plan to follow up on that.
Okay.
But obviously, there's also the phone call scam, you know. I mean, you know, when I worked in Waupun State Prison in Wisconsin, one of my jobs was I ran the home telephone call system for the inmates during rec periods. So they could make calls to people on their visiting list. You know, every prisoner has a visiting list, an approved visiting list. And you can't visit with somebody who's not on your approved list, and you can't call somebody who's not on your approved list. That's the way it worked in Wisconsin. So they would collect person-to-person calls, and the costs were large. And actually, it's become a scandal in a few states that the telephone companies are making so much money on these calls. So this is significant, but it's also knowable. What we need to do is to conduct a survey, a representative survey of families of prisoners and find out what costs they're incurring. And if I can find funding, I intend to do that. There's lost wages, also referred to as the productivity of the inmate. We can estimate that quite well, actually. Lost fringe benefits on lost wages, another item we can estimate pretty well. Lost taxes on wages, that's a cost to the state. When you prevent a person from working by putting them in prison, the state loses the taxes that they would get on that person's wages. Now, not all prisoners or former prisoners or ex-prisoners are working, but we know approximately what percent are working, and we have a way of calculating what they would earn. There's lost household productivity. A person who's an adult who's a member of a household contributes to that household. And you can calculate that, and I did. And then this is a very important element. This is critical. Pain and suffering of prisoners and families. These are what we call quality of life costs. It's not inconsequential to lose an adult member of your household to prison. Generally speaking, the households, households that lose an adult member to prison suffer a serious economic decline immediately following imprisonment, continuing for some period of time. They suffer loss of companionship. Those things, you can't ignore those things. Children suffer the loss of the presence of a parent. Those are changes in quality of life. It's what economists call disutility. It's kind of an opaque term, but that's what it means. Disutility means pain and suffering. And actually, I devised a method for calculating this. There's post-release supervision, meaning parole. This is the cost that can be determined. And Gail referred to these costs. And of these costs, only the family support of the inmate is currently unestimated. And then there's more. There's post-release decline in wages. Let me go back to that. This is really important. An ex-prisoner, by my calculations, earns about 35.5% less than a comparable person who has not been in prison. And that's that effect endures for a long period. Having read the literature on this, I would not want to be an ex-prisoner. I mean, you're in such a deep hole. I'd think about selling drugs, frankly. I mean, this is, you can't make it. But anyway, let's go on. There's lost fringes on lost future earnings. There's lost taxes on loan. Actually, this is a state cost. It kind of mounts up. There's depleted neighborhood economic strength and quality of life. I won't discuss that. I discussed that in the paper. It has to do with the fact that imprisonment is a disproportional effect in the sense that it concentrates on certain racial and ethnic groups and on certain neighborhoods. Now, in New Mexico, I don't know the exact patterning, but I remember from Gail's slides last night that imprisonment in New Mexico falls disproportionately on Latinos. So there are a larger number of Latinos in prison than they represent a portion of the state population. And there are fewer whites in prison than whites represent a proportion of the state population. And it looked to me from her slides that was significant. So as I recall, about 53% of the prisoners were of Latino ancestry. And I don't believe that Latinos constitute 53% of the state population. Am I right on this?
It's close. 53%
Spanish, right?
Yeah, for women.
The majority population.
Oh, what is the portion of the state population then that's Latino?
Somebody else know that
besides me. It's about 45.
Yeah, for many years it was really one third Native American, one third Hispanic, one third Anglo, and it's gradually.
It's only up to 12% Native American.
Yeah, it's gradually moved over the last 20 years in particular.
Right. Right. And if I recall also from Gail's slide, I believe that there was some imbalance in the proportion of prisoners who are Native American.
Yeah.
It was like 9%, 8%? Oh, yeah. 8 minutes. Okay. Let me go on. Anyway, what happens is that the concentration of prison effects creates a churning of males in particular neighborhoods and in particular ethnic groups. Churning meaning a rotation through prison and back into the neighborhood. And that churning, as shown by the work of Todd Clear and other criminologists, depresses neighborhood economic activity and neighborhood social capital. So I call your attention to the work of Todd Clear if you check that out. There are adverse effects on children, probably. I mean, I Carol talked about that. I think more work needs to be done on that. There are additional social, health, and educational services. that are used by dependents, dependents of the prisoner. Okay, the social benefits of incarceration. There are three kinds. Let me just show them here. There's deterrence, incapacitation, and retribution. That's all in your spiral-bound book, and I'm not going to discuss this at this time. These are the three major types of benefit. I don't want to take the time for that. Now, the benefits, the social benefits of incarceration, here's my inventory. Reduces costs of insurance. You know, if you suppress criminal activity by putting people in prison, then your insurance costs are going to be less. Like if car theft, auto theft in New Mexico drops by 10 or 15%, you're going to pay less for your auto insurance. There's the increased value of property in neighborhoods when crime goes down. Your property is worth more. Increased economic activity. I'm not going to go into detail about this. Lowered cost of personal security, meaning that you don't put those bars on your windows if your crime rate is low. But if your crime rate rises, you know, you may put new locks on your doors and bars on your door and window. There's the suppression of negative behavior in a neighborhood. That's a benefit of incarceration. Removal of harmful influence from home. Particularly, as Carol pointed out, some drug offenders are abusive to their families. And therefore, putting them in prison is a net benefit for the family. These require the development of methodologies for estimating these benefits. And that's why there's still work to be done here. Every one of these items, both of social cost and of social benefit, is like a little study in itself. Because you have to develop a methodology for estimating it that's defensible. And you have to go looking for the literature or find analogous literature in another field like health sciences or drug and alcohol abuse, which is mostly where I went fishing for these things because nobody has done this. Removal of harmful role model in the neighborhood is another benefit of incarceration. And improvements in offender health and human capital. That's because some offenders actually improve in prison if they're provided the right services and a sufficient quantity and quality of those services. That's particularly true of women. Women tend to be, who are incarcerated, women, when they arrive, tend to be in very tough shape. There are actually a couple studies that show that like women who were incarcerated in the state of Illinois actually got better in the course of their incarceration in terms of their mental health and their physical health, and in some cases, their preparation for the job market as well. So all the ones that were asterisk are unestimated. Okay, the benefits of incapacitation, I'm going to pass over this fairly quickly. I've been working on this for a while. Let me say this. I've been recalculating the benefits of incapacitation. The benefits of incapacitation are that, yeah, right, thank you, that when a person is in prison, they cannot commit crime. And if they were not in prison, studies show they probably would commit a certain number of crimes. That is, given a cohort of people. Not every prisoner is going to commit crime, but a certain percentage of them will. Now, what I did is I how much do I want to say about this? In Hawaii, drug offenders are incarcerated for an average of 39 months. And drug offender means a person whose major reason for being in prison is either possession, sale, or manufacture of drugs. And that means that that's the major reason. That is the most serious offense for which they're incarcerated. I don't include in this group people who were incarcerated for robbery and oh, by the way, they had a possession charge. No. These are people whose major reason for being in prison was sale, possession, or manufacture of drugs. And on Sunday, I finished my analysis, and I calculated that the net savings for adding one median Hawaii drug felon, and the average drug felon, to a Hawaii prison over the course of 39 months, which is the average sentence, is about $100,000 in reduced crime. It's actually less than $100,000. I don't want to cite the exact figure here. It's less than $100,000 over 39 months. Okay, now, this is just for your benefit. The most costly crimes are the personal violent crimes. And this is well known in the cost of crime literature. In Hawaii, that accounts for about three quarters of the benefit of averted crime. And my analysis from Sunday shows that for Hawaii drug offenders, and I was studying a cohort of drug offenders, their violent crime is about 1.7% of the total crimes they commit. Because I have their complete arrest records back to 1978, and I analyzed their arrest records, and from their arrest records, I predicted the crimes they would commit. There's a methodology around that. The least costly crimes are the property crimes and crimes of public order. And each of those crimes costs, on average, less than $3,000 per crime in economic and quality of life costs. And in Hawaii, the average cost per estimated crime committed is less than $1,000. Now, the reason why there's a difference here is because a lot of the crimes that Hawaii drug felons commit have zero value. For example, a lot of the misdemeanors they committed were driving offenses. Some of the misdemeanors and minor felonies they committed were weapons offenses. So they didn't shoot anybody, but they were caught for possession of a weapon when they were on parole or probation, for example. Those crimes have zero cost, zero social cost. So that's why the average crime committed by a Hawaii drug felon is less than $1,000. And these are all pending recalculation. Actually, I've done the recalculation. I'm just telling you that, you know, I want time to review this and make sure it's all right. Now, let me just show you the way this thing fits. Think of putting people in prison in terms of a 2x2 table here, where social cost, social benefit is down here and social cost is here. It costs more to incarcerate a woman, other things equal, than a man. Women have more needs and are in worse shape when they come in. It also costs more to incarcerate a parent than a non-parent. And the reason should be obvious, because there are costs to the family and the children, you know, the cost to the partner and the children. And I'm going to detail those costs in a minute. So keep this in mind. This is a frame of reference. And what the conclusion from this is that you should look carefully at what kind of people you're incarcerating and for what kinds of offenses. Because your return on investment is going to be vastly different depending on who you incarcerate and what they did or what they would do. Okay, who bears the cost? Now let me show you my calculations. I'll show you first the categories. Here are family costs. These are costs of incarcerating a parent that fall on the family who is still out there in the community. Child care, support of the inmate during prison, post-release housing. A lot of families, for example, when a young man comes out of prison, let's say at age 25, because most crime is committed by young men, they'll frequently move back in with their parents. They won't be able to find housing. Housing is a huge issue for people being released from prison. There's lost household productivity, meaning that the adult who was sent to prison doesn't contribute to the household. There's pain and suffering for the children, pain and suffering for the partner, and long-term effects on children, and long-term effects on partner. The long-term effects, I'm still working on. The major costs are the ones that are underlying. Here's some of the inmate costs. These costs accrue to the person who was in prison. Legal defense, efforts to avoid prison. That might sound like an odd one, but we can discuss it later. It's actually part of the equation. Lost productivity, that means the person wasn't earning wages while they were in prison. Well, oops. Wait, stop that. Volume, okay. Lost fringe benefits, post-release declining wages, very significant pain and suffering. Okay, now, here's some of my analysis. I'll let you take a peek at my analysis from Hawaii. Here's what it costs the family, and this is all calculated for 39 months, because that's the average length of stay for a Hawaii drug felon. So right here is what it costs the family to cover the supervision of children that that parent would otherwise provide. And this is based on the market value of child care costs in Hawaii for certain ages of children. I'm going to ask for a little forbearance here. Here is the total cost to the family over a period of 39 months for having a parent of these children and a partner incarcerated, about $350,000. A good deal of it, as you can see, is pain and suffering for the children here. My pain and suffering calculations are, I think, conservative. They're based on the assumption that the children's quality of life declines by 10% from having a parent in prison. I find that very conservative. I talked to a person yesterday who had a parent in prison, and they said 10% is very conservative. It's probably more than that. If you can imagine being disconnected from your parent. The calculation of pain and suffering for the partner is based on the assumption that the partner, that only about half of partners are truly fully engaged with the incarcerated person, because a lot of these relationships are disrupted. So I'm basing it on the assumption that of all parents who go to prison, only 50% have an engaged relationship with a partner on the outside. And it's also based on the assumption that those 50% of partners on the outside, that their quality of life declines by 10%. Now here are the offender costs from Hawaii. Private legal defense, here's lost wages while they're in prison. That's fairly significant, $59,000. I stand by that estimate, that's a good solid estimate. Here's lost fringe benefits. That's based on an average United States Bureau of Labor Statistics calculation that says that benefits nationally are about 30% of wages. Here's lost future earnings, about $59,000. Again, based on my calculations that wages decline about 35.5% post-release. Here's lost fringes, and here's prisoners' pain and suffering. That's based on the assumption, again, I think this is incredibly conservative, that the prisoner's quality of life declines 20% by being in prison. I think it declines by more than that. 20% is... Okay, let's go on.
Dr. McGill,
yes.
Back to the pain and suffering of the children,
really
struck me as I was reading a lot of research, in preparation for finding you and Dr. Cooper, that there's not a lot known about the children because they do get lost. Often when, especially mom goes to prison, grandparents or even another family member take the children because they don't qualify for social services and they're not getting additional income to take care of the kids. Maybe mom did. Maybe she was a TANF recipient before she was incarcerated, but the family who takes the children don't qualify.
Right.
So even though there's more financial obligation on their part, there's not assistance that goes with it. Different things occur with the children, and they're not identified as a group. I don't think there's been a lot of research specifically looking at them as a group of children of incarcerated. They kind of get lost in that whole mix of poverty and that kind of thing. So I would tend to agree with you that those figures are extremely low as they pertain to children, because I think we just have not done maybe there hasn't been as much interest, or maybe there just hasn't been that research done to this point, really tracking the kids to see where they end up and the circumstances. Often when grandparents take the kiddos, they may already be retired or they're on limited income for whatever reason. And then, as you mentioned, all those costs that that family incurs, they try to take the kiddos to visit the parent, especially again if it's a mom kind of thing. And, you know, their poverty situation is on the incline, but yet they don't receive a lot of social services assistance.
Well, actually, that's a significant contribution to my analysis, because I'm going to have to look at the costs borne by relatives. That I haven't included in the analysis. In a way, it's analogous to the situation of foster care, because a lot of children who are placed outside the home of the custodial parent end up with relatives who do not receive official support from the governmental entities that are charged, you know, by social services. So there's an analogy then between what happens to children when they're placed outside the home and what happens to children when a parent goes to prison. Let me just finish. Write down your question or make a little note, and we'll return to it because I'm almost done. Now let's look at New York and Hawaii in my analysis here. Now, this is a different table than what's in the book. The book, the table didn't print out correctly because of contrast settings in PowerPoint. I've changed this table from last night. I've included some of my Hawaii analysis. I want to, what was that? Here we go. Here are the costs for the family. Here's the 350 grand that it costs the family when a parent goes to prison. Here's the cost for New York. They're somewhat less. There are no benefits to the family. There may be a few, but I haven't estimated them yet. But I think they're relatively small, and I had them on an earlier list. Costs less benefits, and here's the New York figure. Now, let's look at society here. This society cost means what does it cost the state? See, what I tried to do is to split out the costs to the state from the costs to the family and the cost to the offender, because there's a big debate in the economics literature on crime about direct costs and indirect costs, and people debate, well, should you include costs to the offender, or is that just desserts? And so the way around that is to split out the costs, and then you can pick what you want to consider. Okay? Now, I choose to consider everything because I'm looking from a societal perspective. But if you just want to concentrate on the cost of the state, that's in this column here. Now, what I want to point out here is that I've revised my analysis based on my new understanding of Hawaii. And the costs of incarcerating an adult in Hawaii for 39 months, less the benefits, subtracting back the value of averted crime, the cost of the state of Hawaii are actually $68,000 per inmate. Okay, this is my new calculation. And so what does that mean? It means every time Hawaii sends a parent to prison for a drug charge, they're taking on a loss of $68,000. Just take out a gun and shoot yourself in the foot. I mean, that's what you're doing. Okay, so I compared this in another analysis that you won't see to what it costs to put a drug offender in treatment. And there are different levels of treatment in Hawaii. You know, you can have outpatient treatment for 12 weeks, and then you can have, you know, there's intensive, then there's less, followed by less intensive. You can have residential treatment for drug abuse in Hawaii, and that costs a lot more. And so I figured out, if you take this figure here, $168,000, almost $169,000, how much drug treatment could you buy with that? And I figured out, based on the market value of residential drug treatment in Hawaii, that you could treat a person for about 11 years. So what the analysis shows is that when you put a drug offender in prison in Hawaii, and actually in New York as well, and I won't get into that here, you're getting a negative return on investment. That's the point. Here are a few figures from that put New Mexico in the perspective of the other states. It's very tentative, and there's just a few facts here. The profile of New Mexico needs to be much further developed. I keep pushing the wrong button. There we go. Here's the lost productivity in comparison to the other states. Here's the projected wage upon release, which is based on this figure right here. That's the state mean annual wage from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It shows that apparently New Mexico has somewhat lower, it suggests that New Mexico has somewhat lower costs than these other two states for incarcerating a prisoner. Here are some conclusions, and they are sort of implicit in everything I've said. The external cost, this is this debated point I said before, the cost of prison and the criminal justice system, that's the costs to the state, are just the tip of the iceberg. Incarceration spreads costs. The family and the offender bear very heavy costs. And alternatives to prison would probably be cost effective for all but violent prisoners, prisoners who have a fairly consistent history of committing personal crimes. And obviously more work is required. Here are some suggestions for New Mexico. An investment in the research capacity of human services and corrections is probably called for, so that you can understand what kind of investments you're making when you put a person in prison. You need to develop more information on parents and their children. Like, for example, where are the children living? Of the children whose parents are in prison in New Mexico, how many of those children are in foster care? That's an important fact. Needs to be known. We don't know it right now. You need to survey your families to find out what kind of costs they're bearing, if you're serious about families. And my suggestion is that you actually fund a rigorous cost-benefit analysis of incarceration and find out where your money's going and what kind of return you're getting on it. And you need to, of course, compare the costs of community-based alternatives. And I think that's the end, and here are my acknowledgments. So, thanks very much.
Thank you. We do have some time.
And there were some questions right here Dr. Lindell was going to come back to.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I do want to, I hadn't remembered earlier, hopefully the sound picked up okay, we are making a sound recording of this, but I am going to float around with Mike. So
and I'll stand up here.
And also, as we get started with that, I do want to point out that there is an evaluation in the back. Some of you were here yesterday, so if you've already filled one out, you're good, but if you're here this morning, we do ask that you fill that out so we have you back on the seminar. Okay, starting on the clock. It should be on.
So, my question was just on, again, and maybe I just didn't pick it up, how you estimated the cost of pain and suffering for children?
Yes. That's an interesting subject. I used the concept from the health economics literature called the quality adjusted life year. And let's see how to explain this. The concept of a quality adjusted life year is that a normal, fully functional life has a value of one. And things that impinge on quality of life, like having a disease or having a disability, reduce the quality of life by a certain amount. And in the health science literature, health economics literature, they've actually done surveys and composed scales that summarize how much quality of life is reduced by certain conditions. Now, let me give you two examples. One example would be a time-limited disease like bronchitis or pneumonia. So there are actually studies in health economics that calculate how much a person's quality of life is reduced by a typical bout of pneumonia. Let's say that doesn't result, or I think they do it where it results in hospitalization. So they calculate and they say, well, you know, that results in a reduction of quality of life of 20% over 6 weeks. And then using the concept of the value of a statistical life year, and by the way, I'll give you the literature on this if you want. Using the concept of a statistical life year, they assign a dollar value to a statistical life year, and then you apply the reduction in quality of life to the value of a statistical life year. Okay? An example would be, let's say that a statistical life year is valued at, and this is not the same as the value of life, but a statistical life year, let's say it's valued at $300,000. And a particular condition results in a reduction in quality of life of 10% over the course of a year. Then the value of that would be $30,000. That would be the value of that reduction in quality of life. So that is how, that is the methodology that I applied. It's the same that they use in health economics. But they also do this with disabilities. If you have a reading disability, they've actually composed scales that say how much that reduces your quality of life. Or if you have a cognitive disability, or if you have a physical disability, they actually have scales that show approximately how much that reduces your quality of life, or it shows a range of values depending on the severity of the condition, mild, moderate, and severe. So profound blindness, for example, is in these scales said to reduce quality of life by 50%.
Okay, so so then I guess the question is how, or how do the, I guess these scales define pain and suffering for children then? And what, you know, what is the definition, what are they connected to? You know, the quality of life, pain and suffering,
and
the parent being incarcerated.
What I'd like to do is refer you to the paper where I discuss this at length and provide the calculations and an appendix. The paper is called Spreading the Pain, the Social Cost of Incarcerating Parents. And it's available at www.allianceone.org.
Alliance One, like
the number one.
Just one.
The numeral one. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's in, under Research and Evaluation Services in the article archives. And I have a long discussion in that paper, probably 4 or 5 pages, of how these calculations were done. And then there's an appendix that shows in a spreadsheet how the actual calculation works out.
Great, thanks.
It would be too much to do it here without a whiteboard.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
In the legal system, there are certain values attached to various injuries, disabilities that are resulting of injury. Is the same method for calculating those values the same method that you would use in economic calculation for quality of life and so forth? Because the reason I'm asking this is because if those methods of calculation are different, then how can we assume that they are correct?
Okay. The general answer to your question is no, they don't use the same methods. In the legal system, this now involves the history of the development of the economics of crime. The concept of jury awards for injuries played a pivotal role in calculating the costs of crime. So in a seminal paper in about 1986, a guy named Mark Cohen actually went out and and used a national database on jury awards to calculate how much people got as a settlement for things like aggravated assault, or murder, or rape. And he used jury awards as evidence of the market value of particular crimes. So costs that were determined in the legal system are implicated in valuing the cost of crime, not necessarily valuing the quality of life. Quality of life, this is a difficult issue, but quality of life comes out of the health economics literature, and in order to understand how it gets assigned a dollar value, you need to look at a couple of my references in the paper that I just cited. In particular, this is coming from the work of a guy named Michael French at University of Florida. And he's a health economist, and he's the one who's contributed most of the development of this concept of the value of a statistical life year and how this can help us understand changes in quality of life. So the quality of life costs and estimation, it does not come out of costs fixed in the legal system.
Well, I guess the extension of the question is then, if the systems are different, this seems to leave a lot of room for miscalculation or misunderstanding of those kinds of statistics. If, for example, as a mediator, there are certain values placed on the life of children of a certain age. A six-year-old is less valuable, and therefore less those figures that are used to calculate insurance reimbursements to families who may lose a child or lose mm-hmm. a father or something. So if each system uses a different calculation for those figures, how can we put very much credibility in them? Do you have to move then from system to system and then calculation to calculation to use those figures?
Well, no. I mean, I'm relying on health economics.
Well, I understand that for your system, but I'm looking at the bigger picture because there are many things where we calculate value to create social change of one kind or another.
I'm not sure I understand your question, really, I have to say. What do you mean by moving from system to system?
Well, the criminal justice system who might place certain value based on jury awards, which is different from a health economist who may look at, who may calculate a cost for, a value for, I'm getting myself confused.
Right. Well, here's the issue.
Does anybody see the fallacy in what I'm talking about besides me? It doesn't matter then.
Well, no. I mean, here's the issue. When
is there anyone else who sees what I'm talking about here?
Are you asking, about the different systems that come from different perspectives, you're putting a different value on, how you define what the problem is?
And the mathematical calculation, which may be a unique one to a particular system.
Right.
And so then how do we, as people who are trying to change society, how can we even be respectable in terms of the data that we're producing and then try to use to change attitudes and practices and so forth?
Here's the general principle that you use when you're trying to assign a cost to something. You try to identify where there's a market for it. And you say that the market defines the cost. Now, in terms of crimes committed, what Cohen asserted in his work, and it's been going on for about 25 years now, he said the market for crime is in the legal system. So that, where else is there a market for crime that assigns value to crime? I mean, that was the genius of his proposition. That's where we're going to see the market applied to crime. Now, there are other methods for evaluating the cost of crime. There's a willingness to pay methodology. And in that kind of study, I discussed it last night, you apply a survey to a large number of people and you say something like, how much would you be willing to pay to avoid a burglary in your home? You have to be very careful the way you word the questions, and there's a set way of doing it. But that's another way for defining the market. But certainly, if the legal system awards money for the suffering that a person has as a result of a crime, that's a way of using the market to define value. Now, in health, we don't have a market like that, you know? So you look for wherever there is a market or an indication of value. Now, the federal government has invested a lot of money in trying to define the costs of disease, the Centers for Disease Control. And that's the best literature there is on the costs of disease. And so that's as close to quality of life as I can get. And so that's the literature I use. And I analogize between quality of life lost when a person is in prison and quality of life lost either when you suffer a disability or when you suffer a disease. Those aren't fundamentally different. So here's the way I argue in the paper that I published. If you're bedridden for a certain period of time and are unable to leave your room and require constant care, there's an analogy between that situation and being in prison. There's a loss of freedom. There's a loss of a lot of voluntary aspects of your existence. I don't see a fundamental difference there. I don't see a difference in principle between restrictions that result from disability and disease and restrictions that are imposed by social policy. What it amounts to, if I were going to generalize and put all of this together, I refer to it as a policy-induced change in functional state. Now that sounds like a fancy term. But what it means is that you have instituted social policies that affect a person's ability to function. Another example would be taking custody of a child and placing them outside the home. That is a policy-induced change in functional state for the child. It changes the child's quality of life. And if we're going to apply cost-benefit analysis and understand what our return on investment is, we have to have a way of valuing the change in a child's quality of life imposed by taking them into custody and, for example, putting them in a group home or in foster care. And that's where this line of analysis leads. And so that's what this is about. I mean, no one has done this before, and so it's natural that there are going to be some questions and challenges. But that is the basic direction of this analysis.
Thank you. I'm going to move us along a little bit. I know we're right at 10:30 or a little bit after, but this part of the program is also designed for some possible interaction. We've got several agencies represented, and so we don't want to keep people on time. We know you are all very busy folks, but if you have a few more minutes, if you have questions for each other in terms of things that are going on within your agencies, you know, additional questions for the speaker are also welcomed as well. But I did want to make sure that you knew that this part is also designed for you all to brainstorm or ask questions of each other related to what's going on in various agencies.
What I wanted to add was on the removal of harmful influences at home. We've had so many parents that have said, you know, since Junior's been locked up, I've never had a good night's sleep, because they've always wondered, what is he doing, what's happening? So I thought that was interesting. I had never looked at that as an unestimated benefit. Also, just to add some of the things, and it's really information sharing with other agencies, some of the things that the Corrections Department does now, and you know, we've all heard the term better late than never, is now we actually have televisits where parents can visit with their children. We have it at the Hobbs Prison for the men and at the Grants Prison for the women, where we never had that before. So if it's too far for them to travel, children can actually have that televisit. We also have parenting classes, and now we have overnight visitation where the mother can implement the skills that she's learned and have an actual 24-hour visit overnight with their child and or children. And she has to make out a menu, has to work with that child, and that has been very beneficial. We also have family visits, and we're talking about visitation. We provide gas cards for families to bring their children to visit their mother. If they have children under 18 years old, and they live all around the state, we really want to promote that family reunification, that bonding, and we will provide them with gas so they can come and visit. People don't understand that when men go to prison, they always have the wife or the mother or the girlfriend to take the children to visit. When it's the mother that goes to prison, there's no longer a guy or a man or a husband. Usually her mother ends up taking care of her children. So on visitation day at the women's facility, you may have three or four visits. Or at the male facility, there are so many visits that they have to be dismissed early just to allow everybody to visit. And people always think, oh my gosh, the women's prison, you know, there's a line to get in, but it doesn't happen that way. So we really try to encourage that visitation.
Well, that's a very interesting thing. Can we pick that up?
Sure.
What I would ask is what's our basis for saying how many children live with which parent? In other words, have we done a survey here in New Mexico of where the children of incarcerated parents are actually placed and living currently?
You know, we have looked at that, but it's very interesting because specifically with women, a lot of times women will not reveal that they have children for fear that they're going to take those children away. So you will have children that come to prison. You ask them, how many children do you have? I don't have any. Because if they're staying with their friends, cousins, brother, sister, they don't want us to know. They don't want anyone to know because they fear losing their children. So we have asked that question. We try to get that information. But a lot of times we don't get honest information. At one time, we had a health fair at the prison where we were trying to get incarcerated parents, their children on Medicaid, I'm sorry, I get those two mixed up. And the big rumor around the prison was, don't give them any information about your children because they'll take them away. So they're not very trusting of the system because of that fear. And like we said earlier, grandparents are now having to raise their children's children because of incarceration.
Just a real short add to that. For those fathers who are in the Nurturing Parenting Program at Southern, we do have that information, but it's, you know, it's not the general population. It's just those that are enrolled in the program because we do make contact with all of their, we call them parenting partners because they're not always an intimate partner or even a mother. Sometimes it's a brother. You know, sometimes it's hard to say who it's going to be. But we do invite them to be a part of the program on the outside. So,
and it is different for men because usually the wife or the girlfriend or the mother are taking care of their children. But for the woman, when she goes to prison, you know, the significant other that was there usually disappears. So he's not going to be a responsible parent. So I see that big difference with the men and the women.
It looked like that nationally the averages were about 70% of the women were living with their children at the time of incarceration.
It's about 65, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics.
Okay. Wait, and you commented last night that often that's in a decline. You know, before the incarceration for several months, there's more and more problems, and the children are left different places. And
yes.
So their you know, environment has deteriorated for several months before mom goes to prison. But up until that time and the chaos, that 65 to 70%, but it looks like there's 40% or less of the men actually living with the family.
In the month before prison, yes.
Right, in the time of incarceration.
Right.
So, you know, those are national averages, but they're probably pretty realistic, would you guys say, from your experience?
I just had a question in terms of those kinds of averages. As we've been kind of studying and looking at these programs, it seems like often grandma really is the person who has the kids, and mom is in the home, she's in and out of the home, but it, at least to me, I don't think they're, and I don't have any evidence, but it did seem like they're, most of these kids are coming into our custody, they're really with grandma, and mom is in the home because it's usually mom, but they're, mom really isn't the main the primary caretaker. Grandma has been. Yesterday I was at a conference and we have, I don't know, I'm going to say 30 between all the different panels of men who had been young boys, 16 to 22, who had been impacted by this, and it was like a male conference and we were talking about fatherhood, and it was so interesting how the absence of fatherhood was huge. None of them talked about their dad. A few talked about uncles, but very, very few talked about even their mom. They mostly talked about grandma. Just anecdotal.
Yeah, I did just have one. I keep going back to the calculating pain and suffering thing, and I think part of it, you know, with the kids, with the children, anyways, in the programs that have been state funded in the pilots, we just published, I think, last week, a preliminary report that we can get to everyone if they want to look at it on the first 6 months of the pilot programs in Bernalillo County and San Miguel County detention centers. They're, you know, not the prisons, but they're the detention centers. And what we've been trying to focus on, besides the you know, contact visitation and stuff, is the kind of like the upfront trying to identify the kids as the parents are arrested, coming into jail, and you know, like I think a few people have said, it's hard because to identify them all the time because they don't always trust the person who's asking. And what we have found is that they're much more likely to tell someone that they're familiar with, you know, who works, that they know and have a relationship with, or, you know, in the smaller facility than somewhere else. So we've been had more success in identifying all of the parents than at a larger facility when people are in and out all the time. And I think as far as, you know, the cost of pain and suffering, we're trying to look at, you know, mitigating that pain and suffering of the children and, you know, caregivers to begin with, and getting them, you know, services and resources they need, identifying them up front when the parents arrested, and then trying to connect them to it, you know, instead of also having them go into foster care. And that's just in the definition of the pain and suffering and the costs, you know, of children. It's been, you know, I'm trying to just grapple with how do we define that, and then how do you put a value on that? Because, you know, the pain and suffering can be defined from the beginning as, you know, the trauma of watching your parent being arrested, being separated, you get home from school, then, you know, then mom's not there. You know, how do you describe to the kids at school what's going on? You know, there's a lot of different, you know, internal emotional factors, but then later on, you know, then there's economic factors, and then later on,
they come into
our system. Maybe, or they go into the juvenile justice system, and then, you know, it's like compounding costs as they get older. So it's just, and we've actually been asked recently, you know, by the legislature to, well, what are the benefits to these programs? Put numbers to it, you know, as far as the parent, and it's been really, really tough to calculate. So I think that that is something that we're still struggling with, and that we need to, yeah, really figure out how to put a money value.
Let me make one comment about canned subject. I think probably one of the things that struck people is that the pain and suffering costs that I estimated are quite high. And I just wanted to make a technical note here, that the pain and suffering costs that I calculate are adjusted for the average number of children that an incarcerated parent has. So the pain and suffering costs in my tables are actually calculated for 2.07 children, which is the average number of children that an incarcerated parent has according to the national surveys. It's not for one, it's not per child, it's per parent.
Per parent is incarcerated?
Yes. So that's one reason that the pain and suffering costs are high. In terms of mitigating the pain and suffering, I'm not sure how much in-prison activities would be able, and I'm sort of reasoning intuitively here, I'm not sure how much in-prison activities are going to be able to mitigate the effects of enforced separation. Because if you think about family dynamics and family systems, it's the constant presence of the parent that serves as the role model and that communicates values. And I'm not sure you get anywhere near the same effect from periodic contact, no matter what the quality of that contact is.
Among the social costs, you've listed additional educational services, and I just wonder what the primary educational services are that you're looking at. I'm talking about in public schools, I guess, for these kids.
Things like special education, for kids that are that have one degree or another of emotional disturbance.
That would be the primary.
Do we have any other questions or discussion? And we will go ahead and wrap up the official part of the program this morning. Once again, thank our speakers, although we didn't feel them much. We very much appreciate their presence here over the last couple of days. And I want to thank everyone who is in attendance here this morning as well. Not only for your attendance here today, but for the work that you do every day on behalf of New Mexico individuals and families. So thanks again so much. We hope to be in contact with people throughout the year, and again, see you next year at our fifth annual Family Impact Seminar. Thank you.